Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Leela Chinia.
Starhawk is an activist, organizer, and author, and she's in Palestine for the third time teaching nonviolent intervention to peace activists. And we've finally reached her at her hotel in Jerusalem. Hi, Starhawk, and thanks so much for sticking in there with us, and I'm glad we got a hold of you.
Hi.
Now, I was beginning before by asking you about the International Solidarity Movement. Could you just tell us a bit about who the ISM volunteers are and where they come from?
The International Solidarity Movement is kind of a coalition of individuals and groups that are here to support the civilian population in Palestine and the nonviolent resistance. And the volunteers really range, it's an amazing range of people. I'm here actually with my friend Jean, who's 76 years old, who's from Gabriola Island up your way. Some of the volunteers are as young as 18. One of the coordinators down in Rafah is only 18 years old, from England. They come from all walks of life. There are students. There's a man in our training who's a laid-off pilot from one of the airlines who was a Marine. It's really quite a mix of people.
And what's the role, a typical role for these volunteers? What are they doing?
We do a number of different things. We try to support Palestinian efforts and nonviolent resistance. For the Palestinians to mount a demonstration, say, against curfew, or to remove a roadblock that's keeping their village from being able to get supplies in or ambulances in, it's a very dangerous thing. They can get shot. They can get arrested. Palestinian men of fighting age can be basically detained for 6 months with no trial and no reason and no explanation. Oftentimes when they are arrested, they're beaten or tortured. For internationals, it's a bit safer. When internationals are present, the soldiers are less likely to shoot live ammunition at people. So we can provide a little margin of safety for Palestinians who want to do organized nonviolent resistance. And we also do a lot of accompaniment, a lot of just basic protection of civilians, human shield kind of work, staying in houses that are at risk for being demolished, either because somebody in the family has been involved in armed resistance or is targeted in some way by the authorities. Doesn't mean that the whole family supports that. It just means that, you know, your cousin Ben is targeted as a fighter and you go and blow up everybody's house in the extended family. Or because the house simply happens to be in the wrong place. When I was down in Rafah last week, we were staying in houses that are on the border with Egypt, and what they're doing is clearing a huge security zone there, and so they're basically just confiscating people's land, tearing up olive groves and orange groves that have been there for hundreds of years, bulldozing people's houses, and with no compensation to the people involved. So we'd stay in the houses to try to prevent them from being demolished, or we'd go out and try to prevent soldiers from shooting at civilians. We might accompany people in an occupied refugee camp or an area that's under a military operation who need to get to a clinic or a hospital. People have been riding with ambulances to help them get through checkpoints and get to patients, or walking kids to school to help them get through the checkpoints and get to school.
So it sounds like, as you were saying, that the presence of internationals there, of folks outside of the area, is a protective factor. But just thinking, 2 weeks ago, ISM member Rachel Corey was killed while trying to protect a Palestinian home from being demolished. And I know that you've been in Rafah comforting the team that was with Rachel. How has Rachel's death affected morale, first of all?
Well, morale here is still very strong. You know, people, of course, are really shocked and saddened and grieved by Rachel's death, but nobody has turned around and said, oh, I'm leaving. In fact, I think it's made people more determined. And in fact, we've received such great support from the community. Down in Rafa, I think the community there was a little uncertain about the international volunteers. It was something new there. It wasn't quite as common as it has been on the West Bank. And they often didn't know what to make of people. And they weren't sure, are these people really serious? Are they Israeli agents? You know, who are they? What are they doing here? Since Rachel's death, there's just been a tremendous warmth and acceptance from all the people. I think it made them realize that people who are here really are serious about trying to do something about the occupation and are willing to really risk themselves in that cause. And so, you know, again, everybody's really sad, but I think the morale is still very strong.
And how do you think that this, that her murder has impacted just the role that that internationals are playing in the protectiveness?
Well, you know, it's made us really look, you know, deeply at what we're doing. None of us are here because we want to be martyrs or because we want to die. We're here because we want to do something effective for the people here. And Rachel certainly did not want to die. You know, she was full of plans for what she was going to do and ongoing plans for the work she wanted to do around this issue. We all know that there's certainly a chance that that could happen. That's part of the risk that you accept when you come into a situation like this where people are fighting and people are shooting live ammunition and all kinds of things could happen. So I would say it's maybe made us think more cautiously about some of the kinds of actions that we're doing, saying, you know, the point of trying to stop the bulldozers is to stop the bulldozers, not to get run over by them. And at what point do you say, okay, this is actually working, and at what point do you say, okay, we actually do need to get out of the way here? And it's not an easy judgment call. You know, ordinarily you say, okay, this is scary, this is dangerous, I'm getting out of here. But when you're kind of deliberately, constantly putting yourself in situations that are dangerous and scary, sometimes it's hard to find that edge where, like, you go, oh, okay, this crosses the border between dangerous but a reasonable risk to too dangerous, let's not do it.
Now, last week on Red Eye, we actually read some of Rachel Corey's emails home, and she talks a lot about white privilege, and in fact the movement recruits international volunteers because of their privilege, and the belief being that I guess they're much less likely to be targeted by the Israeli military than the Palestinians. So I guess, you know, this just how do you think her murder changes the role of Western ISM members?
Well, I think that it kind of depends on the reaction that the Israeli government gets from it. With a strong political backlash, which I think we've seen, you know, a lot of political pressure, a lot of international outrage, in some ways we felt that the army has actually kind of pulled back since her murder. And people have, you know, the same kids that were down there, I shouldn't call them kids, but they're, you know, a lot of them are really quite young, 18 or 19 years old. They were standing in front of bulldozers 3 days later, and the bulldozers stopped. I was down there, you know, for a week, and it was, for Rafa, a relatively quiet week, which meant that and there was not a lot of home demolitions, but a lot of shooting at night. We were staying in houses that were at risk of being demolished. Two nights ago, they were shooting at our house, and, you know, it's kind of a strange sensation. You're sitting in a very peaceful house with a mother, six little children, all eating, all sitting around a little charcoal fire that they bring in, and you know, everything's very sweet, very peaceful, and then you hear all these gunshots in the background. And the kids don't even react half the time because they're so used to hearing gunshots. But at a certain point, you know, the gunshots were so close that the whole family was diving for the floor. And at that point we said, well, maybe we should make our presence known. So we went out with a bullhorn and a light and saying, you know, we're internationals. We're staying here. We're committed to this house. There are children here. Stop shooting. And we knew there was a tank out there that was shooting, and the tank went away. So we felt like it is still effective. And having international presence, it's like having the eyes of the world on something, lessens the potential for violence. And I think that the authorities in the army are worried by the political pressure and don't want to have the reputation of being murderers. So they are being a little more cautious. And that's good because that saves lives.
And I guess what you bring up for me is that while Rachel's murder is tragic, the everyday oppression and murder of Palestinians is also tragic. And I'm just wondering if you could describe a bit about... I mean, you've been spending a lot of your time in the houses and, as you describe, in the streets with Palestinian people. What's the everyday-to-day life like?
Well, everyday life in Palestine is extremely difficult for the Palestinians. If you can imagine, first of all, many of the Palestinians were making most of their livelihood by going over and working in Israel proper. And a lot of them have been kept out of Israel since the Intifada. So that took away a huge chunk of their economy. Then there have been systematic attacks on other aspects of their economy. For example, in Nablus, where I was 2 weeks ago, they've gone in and blown up all the soap factories in the old city. The soap of Nablus is famous all over the Arab world, and that was a big export. In Gaza, Gaza is kind of the ultimate colony. They're not allowed to export anything that's produced in Israel or to import anything from outside of Israel that's produced in Israel. So they're entirely dependent on, you know, the Israeli products. They're not really allowed to develop any industry of their own. They used to have a good livelihood from growing flowers and exporting flowers into Israel. But since the Intifada, what happens is to get out of Gaza, essentially you pass through an international border, and they would hold up the shipments of flowers at the border so long that the flowers would just rot and it became impossible to export them. So you've got massive unemployment. If you do have employment, it generally involves going out of your village, maybe into a city, like if you're in a little village in the West Bank, going into Nablus, you have to go through a checkpoint. There's checkpoints all over the place. And to get through a checkpoint, if the checkpoint's open, it means possibly anything from a mildly humiliating experience where some soldier with a gun looks at you and decides whether you can go or not and checks your papers or looks in your bags or searches you, to a frustrating wait of hours and hours and hours if the checkpoint is closed, to being detained and arbitrarily beaten if somebody's in a bad mood, to not being able to get through at all if they suddenly decide the checkpoint is closed. A lot of the villages, they've blocked off the roads and made it impossible for vehicles to drive in and out. So if you need an ambulance, the ambulance has to stop on one side of the checkpoint. You have to get out, cross maybe a huge roadblock of dirt and mud, walk across the road, get to the village, walk the patient up over the roadblock or carry them if they can't walk and get them into the ambulance, which, as you can imagine, is not great for emergency medical care. It's just constant. Everything from constant minor frustrations to having your house blown up with no warning, you know, just being told to get out and suddenly it's gone, to having people shot. There were 9 people shot in Gaza the day after Rachel Corrie was killed. The same day she was killed, a local guy, a man named Ahmed, had heard about her death, was upset, stepped out of his front door to roll a cigarette, and was gunned down by Israeli soldiers. He was 55 years old. He was a street cleaner. He was sort of a slightly learning disabled guy, but very sweet. Everyone knew him. He wasn't anything remotely like a fighter or a terrorist, and he's just gone. So, you know, yesterday in Bethlehem, a 10-year-old girl was killed when the Israelis decided to target some leaders from Hamas who were riding in a car and just ended up shooting the family in the car behind them as well. You know, it's just a constant, everyday assault. You know, I know that a lot of people are deeply concerned about, you know, the violence in Israel and the suicide bombs. And it's something, you know, I am here because I support nonviolence and I don't want to see anybody killed. But it becomes clear as soon as you're here on the West Bank that it's these conditions of colonization that are creating the frustration that leads to that kind of reaction. And, you know, it's everything that the Israelis claim they're doing to end terrorism is really creating the conditions, the very conditions that breed more rage and more despair and more hopelessness and that lead to that kind of violent act.
Well, Starhawk, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us and to give us a report on just your activities there and just to give us a sense of what's happening over there. So thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad we finally got connected.
Me too. Starhawk is an activist, organizer, and author of 9 books, including Webs of Power, Notes from the Global Uprising. She's in Palestine for the 3rd time, teaching nonviolent intervention to peace activists.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.